I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. We'll talk about a Teflon presidential candidate. Donald Trump standing in the polls was not hurt when he ridiculed John McCain and his years as a prisoner of war, insulted Carly Fiorina's looks, called illegal immigrants from Mexico rapists and killers. He managed to stay on top in a field of crowded candidates. He's also told some whoppers getting more pants on fire and Pinocchios than other candidates from the fact checkers. Here's one from a rally that's been completely discredited.
I watched when the World Trade Center came tumbling down. And I watched in Jersey City, New Jersey, where thousands and thousands of people were cheering as that building was coming down. Thousands of people were cheering.
Trump weighed in on the Syrian refugee crisis on This Week with George Stephanopoulos, referring to President Obama.
That he wants to take in people that have no documentation, no paperwork, no anything from Syria on the migration. People are going to come pouring in. And the number he wants is much higher than 10,000. I've heard it's 200,000. I've even heard 250,000 people.
Trump also tweeted that 81% of white homicide victims were killed by African Americans, which is completely wrong. When asked about it, Trump said, "I retweeted someone that was supposedly an expert. Am I going to check every statistic?" Today on Ballot Talks on Radio Times, what to do about candidates who lie. Joining us are Eric Wemple, media critic for The Washington Post. Eric, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us is Michelle Amezine, assistant professor of advertising at Rider University. She specializes in political advertising. And Michelle, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
I'm glad to be with you, Marty. Thanks.
You're very welcome. Eric, let me begin with you. And I've noticed more reporters, more interviewers, more headlines, more editorials are using the word lie when covering Donald Trump. Has something changed?
Well, certainly not the standards. My sense is that news organizations are just preternaturally opposed to or disinclined to use that word because it requires knowing the state of mind. A lie is something that the utterer knows to be untrue at the time it's stated. It just so happens, though, in the case of Donald Trump, he's been reminded of these untruths so many times that it's almost impossible that he can't be aware of some of the things he's saying. So I think that news organizations are allowing now the use of this nuclear word, a word that, that quote-unquote neutral news organizations really very diligently stay away from. But I think that it's becoming more and more clear that if these untruths aren't deliberately stated, then something else really wacky is going on inside this guy's head.
Well, and we can't put him on a psychiatrist's couch, but Eric, and just based on my observations of Donald Trump, I don't think he cares if he's called out on these various untruths or even lies.
No, that's true. He, I think, enjoys keeping these issues, so to speak, if you want to call them that, floating and bubbling and alive in the news sphere. So I think that, it could be seen as a deliberate strategy. He talks about his polling. He talks about the media. It's all somewhat distractive because, as you notice in some of the debates, when they do drill down pretty deep into policy, he tends to kind of stay quiet. So I think that's part of it, but it is a fantastic and utterly new dynamic to watch in presidential primary politics.
You're saying we've never seen something like this before?
I mean, not on this order of magnitude. I mean, PolitiFact, I think, has more than 40 statements that are in the false category for Donald Trump. And there's so many more. Every time he appeared, he was on an appearance with O'Reilly, and he was talking about some myths, untruths that he had apparently said. And then he said something about Karl Rove, and then Karl Rove got on, a couple minutes later and says, that was false, what he said about me. So, even on segments that are discussing his untruth, more are kicked up. I think it's beyond the ability of anybody to really track.
Well, Michelle, let me get you in on the conversation. And Erica talked about PolitiFact. I'm actually looking here. False statements, 40%, pants on fire, 22%. How do you think fact checkers are are dealing with Donald Trump, and are they able to keep up with his various statements? And do you think they're having an effect on how the public sees him?
Well, I think that the fact checkers have been very busy trying to keep up with everything that Donald Trump, as well as some other candidates, are saying. You know, I think they're doing the best they can. They have a certain process that they go through. And as far as whether they are having an effect, I think it depends on the person. We have evidence that fact-checking does influence people's beliefs and correcting what they believe, but that it's not equal in how it works on everybody.
Well, and just to follow up on that, does it matter sort of who is telling someone, and the someone being, of course, a potential voter? If, let's say, a fact-checking organization is fact-checking Donald Trump, and someone is a supporter, follower of Donald Trump, are they likely to believe that, or does it sort of cement their belief in their candidate?
Well, we have found that the people who are – certain people are less receptive to fact-checking efforts. Those people tend to be high partisans, and conservatives are also less receptive to fact-checking efforts. And those seem to be the type of people who are behind Donald Trump. So these fact-checking efforts may not be as effective on the people who are supporting Donald Trump.
Well, let me read something, and I'll toss this back to you, Eric. This is something that Katie Turr said. She's an NBC reporter. She's been covering Donald Trump, and she talked to some of his supporters at a rally, asking them whether they were bothered by his inaccurate statements. And she said not a single one of them said that they thought it mattered. They said they liked him because they thought he was going to be a strong leader, and they think he's going to bring change to Washington that they want. In fact, they blame the liberal media, as they say, on perpetrating lies about Donald Trump. They repeatedly ask, why didn't you ask this about Hillary Clinton? Why didn't you ask this about President Obama? So for the fact checkers, it seems it's a bit of a conundrum here, is it not?
I don't think it is. I understand what that some people aren't, some people don't share the disgust. So it doesn't particularly resonate with them. Like the fact check, they don't believe the fact checkers. They don't believe stuff that's in mainstream media organizations, and so they just either ignore it or they actively, you know, campaign against it. So I think that's understandable, but I don't think it puts media organizations and fact checkers in a conundrum. It's a good question, but I don't think it does. And the reason I don't think it does is because fact checkers' job is to take a statement and to break it down and to look at it in context and decide whether this is, you know, misleading or not. Whether that has any impact is a completely separate question. And there is, you know, there's a whole great history of, you know, fact checkers having no impact.
Yes.
I mean, this is something that was lamented back, you know, the fact checking sort of got off the ground eight or 9 years ago or whatever it was with factcheck.org. You know, they have constantly lamented their inability to prevent these falsehoods that they cite from recirculating in the political, in political debates. You know, they're particularly incapable, fact-checking that is, of stopping politicians, especially when they're put on the spot, like in debates and so on and so forth. They don't want to admit that they've been gotcha'd, so they continue to rest on things they've said before. So the impotence of fact-checking is nothing new. I mean, I think if you remember Michelle Bachmann in the 2012 election, she stuck to a number of points that she had been busted on, and it didn't really seem to have much impact, and nor did it in the supporters. But I do think that, you know, on the margins, with people who do care, these things are having an impact, and they will have an impact. And I think that once the race moves beyond, you know, sort of its boundaries or its current confines, I think this stuff will have an impact.
Michelle, let me get
Marty,
you. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, if I could just respond to something Eric said.
Absolutely.
That a point is that the primary goal of fact checkers is not to change the behavior of politicians. That may be a secondary goal. Their primary goal is to educate voters. So they are concerned with putting the accurate information
right.
out there.
And I guess the question is whether voters want to hear this information and whether sometimes putting that fact-checking out there, Michelle, hardens someone's belief in what is even misinformation about their candidate.
So the American Press Institute, they are a research think tank about journalism. They have done a study that shows that 80% of Americans, roughly 4 out of 5 Americans, have favorable attitudes towards fact-checking. They want this sort of information. But as I said before, there are some people who, no matter what you present to them, they're not going to change their mind.
And do people like pictures? Do they like, pants? do they like Pinocchios? Do they like pictures? How do people want this information?
So when given a choice between fact checks that offer the rating scales you're referring to, the Truthometer or the Pinocchios,
right.
Slightly more people will select fact checks that use a rating scale. I think it's 56% of people prefer use of the rating scales. Yet there are a substantial minority, 44% of people, who don't like to see that and just want to read the context about why something might be misleading. So we did not find that there is any difference in the effectiveness of a fact check, depending upon whether or not a rating scale is used. So I think there's room for both types of fact checks.
Well, and Eric, you have Pinocchios down there at the Washington Post.
Right. And I, don't want to be too critical of my own shop, but the Pinocchios, if you look at the scale, if you look at, how they define the Pinocchios, if you know that scale, it's good. You know what I mean? But if you don't know what each one means, you might be a little confused because you might think that one Pinocchio is pretty nasty. But if you look at what it means, it's not that bad. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I understand completely, yes.
And so I think that is a consideration. But I do think that I'm one of those people who doesn't care so much for the scales. Factcheck.org, if I'm correct, doesn't use, the gimmickry. And
that's right.
I enjoy those because, they sort of use language. And these things are often layered and nuanced and complex. And so I enjoy those. I enjoy reading through those instead of just coming to that. Rachel Maddow has...
Well, Eric, hold on to that thought only because they're playing my song. We have to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Eric Wemple and Michelle Amezin, our guests, talking about fact-checking. We'll be right back. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Michelle Amezin, assistant professor of advertising at a Rider University. She specializes in political advertising. Eric Wemple, our guest as well, media critic for The Washington Post. And we are talking about candidates who lie. We've been talking a lot about Donald Trump. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Eric, you wanted to say something about Rachel Maddow.
Well, I was just saying that Rachel Maddow had some spats with PolitiFact, and they centered on PolitiFact sort of, half true, half false, mostly true, mostly false. And Maddow was really interesting clash because there were a number of things that President Obama said and other people had said that PolitiFact had said, mostly true or partly true. And Maddow was like, that's fully true. But PolitiFact was like, oh, no, there's context here. And in context, President Obama was being a little bit cagey, a little bit foxy with the truth. And so, sometimes and oftentimes these fact checks get into interpretive territory, interpretive terrain. And that's where... the whole industry, this great industry, I really enjoy it, takes some of its biggest lumps because sometimes it can't just simply say, okay, 2 + 2 = 4, it doesn't equal 3. There is context, mm-hmm. there is interpretation. And I would note that in most cases that I've seen with Donald Trump, that's not the case. In other words, most of the fact checks with Donald Trump proceed on pretty basic factual ground.
Michelle, fact checking takes some time, and I'm thinking about the debates. You think about interviews that are happening in real time. A kind of a disconnect sometimes between whether the person was telling the truth or not, and what it takes to be able to dig into what they say and then post the information about whether it was true or not. How do fact checkers struggle with that?
Well, it is a resource-intensive effort. It's time-consuming. So you're absolutely right. In debates and live interviews, it is extremely difficult to fact check on the fly. Fortunately, political misstatements, not misstatements, political misinformation tends to repeat itself.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it's important for journalists to be paying attention early on in a campaign, especially during the primary season, because many of these claims will come up again. So during debates, it's unbelievable the type of effort and personnel that needs to be mobilized by these fact-checking organizations to do the live fact-checking during the debates. I know PolitiFact has been live tweeting during the recent debates, factcheck.org as well, and I'm sure the fact-checker, the Washington Post fact-checker,
kept busy during the debates as well. Eric, let me go back to you. And, I mean, it's clear that certainly on Fox and certainly on MSNBC and CNN and the other networks, frankly, they see Donald Trump as a prize guest. I mean, he's on those shows all the time. Does that create problems for them in terms of holding his feet to the fire if they want him to be a guest? And I'm assuming they get a ratings bump because of that.
Boy, that's a great question. So many questions within that question.
I understand, but I think you can handle it. Go ahead, Eric.
I'll give it a try. Yes, it is proven, and I interviewed Chris Cuomo of CNN on this, and he stated straight up that it is true that Donald Trump drives ratings on cable TV. That is why when you see him interviewed on whether it's, you know, it's usually Fox and CNN, More commonly on Fox, these interviews go on forever. They blow through commercial breaks to keep him on. He'll be on for 12 minutes on Fox and Friends. He was once on with Chris Cuomo, I think, for 23 straight minutes.
Wow. What was he on the phone? Because I've known.
Yes, he's often on the phone.
Right. Not even in the studio.
And that's one. That's part because he has that leverage. And according to CNN, according to what they tell me there, it's also because he wants to be on the phone, whereas other politicians want to be seen. They want to be present themselves. You know, they look good. They're, you know, they go to the gym, they get in shape, and there they are. They're you know, they want to show their face on TV. That's the way they think they're going to get the best result. But Donald Trump prefers to hang out on the phone. And I do think that there is a tactical dimension to that. He gets to surprise them. He has this advantage that comes with rapping on the phone. Mm-hmm. They can't see what he's thinking and so on and so forth. So anyway, yes, it does create a problem because they try to hold his feet to the fire. But Donald Trump doesn't. He is, if there's anything he's amazing at, it is at handling sort of the logistics of conversation. He is able to distract. He's able to railroad. He's able to filibuster. He does all these things with exactitude and brilliance. And the New York Times just had a podcast about this yesterday that I highly recommend. I wrote about it on my blog. That, you know, Michael Barbaro and Maggie Haberman of the New York Times talked about this isn't just on broadcast. If you call him in a private telephone conversation, he does the same thing. And so it never ends. His ability to dictate the terms of engagement with journalists is unparalleled.
Well, and he also, I'm thinking about this claim that that he saw on television, you know, thousands of Muslims cheering after September 11th. When challenged on that, he wanted an apology from the writer, I believe in the New York Times, who had written the original story. He wants an apology from him.
It's remarkable. It's remarkable bravado, considering that he's been busted by fact checkers on just about, you know, on numerous things, and he refuses to even consider apologizing.
If I can remind you.
Go ahead, Michelle.
After the first debate, when Trump had the run-in with Megyn Kelly,
yes,
he boycotted Fox News for 4 days. And then when he came back on the air after he made up with Roger Ailes, their ratings went back up. So this is a ratings issue.
It's a huge ratings issue. It's a huge ratings issue. They want access to him. He is unlike no other. He's unlike any other candidate. I mean, really, it's remarkable.
Well, I wonder too, and I'll toss this to both of you, and then we got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. Whether then it's the other. If I mean, the press, some, depending on who you're talking about, some are more willing to challenge him than others. But maybe it's up to the candidates, Eric, to do. And I'm thinking of Chris Christie, at least, is challenging Donald Trump on this, you know, the Muslims that he saw celebrating after September 11th. Do you think candidates will have a better shot at going after Donald Trump?
Well, that's another great point. It's the Republican candidates who have to hold him to account, and they largely are not doing that. So when you talk about source credibility, who are conservative voters more likely to listen to, the mainstream media criticizing Trump or people from their own party?
Which is an interesting point. Eric, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I agree with Ms. Amazine. I do not think that the other candidates have been inclined to do this. Chris Christie was interviewed maybe on CNN, perhaps on Fox the other day, and he was asked why has he not been more vocal, because he only said that once or twice. Why haven't you been more vocal on shouting down Trump on stuff like this? And he said, well, you know, I got my own campaign to run, and you know, I'm not going to you know become his fact checker or something along those lines. I think it's a pretty reasonable position, given that Trump is dominating the media so much, why would another candidate want to jump in and add to what is essentially Donald Trump's earned media? I mean, this is the circus that Donald Trump is clearly trying to create. The other consideration, I think, is that ultimately some of these candidates want his voters. So why would you get on record as ridiculing Donald Trump when everybody else pretty much is? So it's a difficult dynamic. It's a difficult
and
dynamic.
Risk drawing Trump's wrath.
Well, I was just going to say that, Michelle. Go ahead.
Because he's a fighter. He doesn't back down, and you know, he's not afraid to have a public spat.
No.
Apparently not. Let me quickly reintroduce you. It's Ballot Talks on Radio Times, talking about lies. We're talking about Donald Trump, how the press is or isn't covering him. Michelle Amazine, assistant professor of advertising at Rider University. She specializes in political advertising. Eric Wemple, our guest as well, media critic for The Washington Post. We got a lot of callers that want to talk to us. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and I'll try to read some emails as we talk to some callers, including, looks like, Adrian from Maryland. Adrian, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I just had a real quick comment. Basically, I was thinking, you know, that I think factcheck.org and all these different, you know, organizations that provide this service should be looked at more as a kind of like an employer, maybe an employee or prospective employer-employee relationship, where, you know, if an employee, you know, submits a resume that's less than stellar, no matter how eminently qualified they are, you know, an employer is less apt to hire that individual. And we, as, you know, the voting constituents are those employers. And I think factcheck.org and the services they're provided, you know, recall to our memory things that we may have forgotten, since we as humans have short memories. And in, you know, this media spin environment and hyperbole, and, you know, guys like Donald Trump promising things that they may not necessarily be able to deliver on, I think those facts kind of give us a another way of viewing these candidates and, you know, just kind of making a better decision for those of us who really want to be informed and not, you know, give in to the appeal to the demagoguery.
Well, Adrian, I appreciate the call. It's a great comment. I appreciate the call. And Michelle, let me put that to you, because what Adrian is saying is, let's be rational. Let's be factual. Let's put the information out, and then people can make a rational decision. But does information work that way? Do voters think that way?
Some voters do. And I think Adrian makes a good point that these fact checkers are providing a service, not just for voters, but also for other journalists. Factcheck.org, as he mentioned, they were the first modern fact checker. And when they emerged in 2003, their initial operation was to provide this information to other journalists so that they could use it in their own reporting. I think their initial slogan was, please steal our stuff.
And now it's kind of morphed, and I think happily so, I think morphed into a different kind of service. Let me read an email from Diane. Why aren't news organizations providing clear and direct information in response to false statements? What I get from that, Eric, is while there might be fact-checking, there might be some of these articles that you and I can refer to, is it really penetrating to the public that wants to know this stuff?
Yeah, I don't know. I can't say what the level of penetration is in terms of the public. What I can say is I have observed in this election cycle more diligence on news organizations to stop for a second and say, by the way, that thing that we just quoted, Trump on, or some other, or Hillary Clinton or whoever it is false. And I do believe that they are doing this more actively. For instance, when, you know, they're covering the Fiorina comments about the Planned Parenthood video, where she said, you know, she described a certain scenario in that those videos, the CMP videos. She described a scene that didn't really exist in those videos. And whenever that's being referenced, especially in the mainstream media, I think all these outlets are very careful to say there's no evidence that this scenario that she discussed in the debate exists. So I think that is becoming more of a standard. I
would
gotta
agree.
Say, what's that?
I would agree with you.
Yeah, I see that more often, and I think that's a good trend. So I have to say that if you're a news consumer and you're not finding that, you're probably not
looking
not
at the right
it.
Places.
Right. Exactly.
Fair enough. Let me get Stephanie from Schwenksville to join our conversation. Stephanie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for doing this show.
Sure.
I imagine that the people that are accepting these lies probably aren't going to listen to a conversation like this. But my comment was that I find it amazing that an example of Trump, that the people that are accepting the lies are the same people that are talking about wanting change in Washington, and that probably one of the biggest complaints about Washington is that there are so many lies. And yet these are the people that are accepting the exact thing that they also complain about.
Well, that's an interesting comment. Michelle, you want to weigh in on that from Stephanie?
Yeah, I don't know what the answer to that is. I can point out that Trump is brilliant at selling his own Trump brand, and he brands himself as this powerful, wealthy outsider who doesn't really answer to anybody. And I think that that's what's having some appeal to some voters, to not have to have an outsider. And I think that complicates the fact-checking issue. So if Donald Trump doesn't have to answer to anybody, why is he going to back down when these fact checks suggest that he's not being accurate?
Well, and Eric, I don't know, are any billionaires outsiders in this country?
What's that?
Are billionaires ever outsiders in this country?
Oh, well, you know, it's interesting you should say that, because Trump is constantly saying when he's on the trail, he talks about, when he's asked about donations, he says, "I gave donations because I wanted something to happen." You know, he's like,
some truth there.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly no lie, and it's a certain degree of openness. And but yes, it raises questions as to just how much of an outsider this guy is.
Well, we're almost at,
he is not accepting any donations from
that's correct.
Super PACs.
Right, and he's not running a lot of ads either, you know. So he's just sort of like running on his own fumes, which are significant.
And Eric, we're almost out of time here, but one thing I noticed that he does is very clever. He'll say, "Well, people say," or "I saw," or "I heard." Those are really hard things to try to you know, put a truth-o-meter to.
100%. I think that's at the very crux of the Muslim thing, because he said, "I watched as thousands of people cheered the destruction of 9/11. So if he watched, that would imply that there's video, right?
Right.
And this is what fact-checkers and all these news organizations have rummaged around for and been unable to find, which is any video that thousands and thousands of people were cheering. Now, there were reports that, you know, here and there, that the little pockets of cheering or whatever, and those were just reports. Now, Michelle, maybe you can help me with this. I don't know that any of those reports has ever, ever been confirmed, such that it's possible that no one was cheering. But certainly there were reports of cheering.
Well, and Michelle, we're almost out of time. Any quick response to what Eric just said?
No, I haven't seen anything that's confirmed that. And Marty, I do want to say that I think it's great that Radio Times is discussing the performance of the media, because I think that happens very infrequently.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. Michelle Amezine, Assistant Professor of Advertising at Rider University, joining us on Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Michelle, thanks so much.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. And Eric Wemple, thank you very much, as always.
Pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. Media critic for The Washington Post. We're going to take a very short break, and then we've got another guest and another topic waiting in the wings. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and this is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. The budget standoff in Pennsylvania is now in its sixth month, and counties and school districts and nonprofits are feeling the pinch. Bucks County officials say they are going to withhold millions in monthly taxes and fees that are normally sent to Harrisburg. We asked Robert Lockery to join us. He's chair of the Bucks County Board of Commissioners. And Robert Lockery, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Good to be with you.
So how much has Bucks County been hurt by this budget standoff?
Well, if we look back to July, when we would have had a budget or anticipated having a budget, we've been fortunate in the county to have a reserve fund that was probably close to $50 million. And we made a decision back then that we would use those funds to continue the services until a budget would come into place. And certainly back then, we didn't think it would be December. To answer your question, our funds have depleted from, you know, $48, $49 million down to, we've probably spent close to $30 million of that at this point. So we're feeling the pinch, and we're looking at the situation where we had to make some decisions. And that was sort of made us decide we're going to hold the money back from the state until we can get a budget in place.
And who came up with this idea?
Well, their finance director. We were meeting a couple, 3 or 4 weeks ago. Ironically, we're in our budget process right now at the county to pass our budget for next year. And so we were going all over several items for the budget and also talking about where we were from a cash flow perspective. Because part of some of the discussion we've had was, well, when does the budget get in place? How much more can we continue to fund it this way? Should we borrow money? Should we stop paying certain people? And we were having this discussion, and the finance director said to me, "Hey, I got a crazy idea or a crazy thought." And I said, "Well, what's that?" He said, "Well, you know, we the county are picking up basically, just for argument's sake, you know, around number $6 to $7 million a month that we're paying out. and we collect and send to the state anywhere between $4 to $5 million a month. And he looked at me and said, maybe we should just use that. And I looked at him and I said, you know what, David, that's not a crazy idea. And that's sort of where the idea came from, you know, about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And then we thought more about it and talked more about it and said, you know what, this is the right thing to do.
And was there a vote on it among the commissioners?
Well, there wasn't a vote. I mean, interestingly, we met with the row officers, and actually the row officers, when you line them all up, and by that I mean the court officers that we have, so the Register of Wills, the Recorder of Deeds, the Clerk of Courts, the Prothonotary, we met and discussed this with them because they are each independently elected and have their responsibilities and fiduciary responsibilities. They collect a lot of these fees and revenues, so the combination of all of that was what we wanted to hold back. So there wasn't a vote per se, but there was a discussion with everyone to say, hey, this is what we're thinking. What are your thoughts? And everybody to a T said, yes, let's do it.
Is this legal? Has your legal department taken a look at this?
Well, the answer to that question is we have. There were some aspects that we felt, I don't think we were ever going to get a clear answer on if it was legal or not legal. And by the time I think we would have gotten an answer, who knows which would have came first, a budget being passed or the legal answer to that question. But we did look at what we felt were statutory obligations. And so, for instance, something that is not being held back, the Register of Wills collects an inheritance tax. In the inheritance tax, there are surety bonds that go with that in order for those to be paid from the estate and to the, you know, back to the Commonwealth. And that was like, that's probably not an area we wanted. So we didn't touch the inheritance tax. As far as the penalties and the other things, there wasn't any clear answer to that. And when I talked to the row officers and we all discussed this, we said, hey, there might be a little bit of risk here. We weighed that. We looked at, like, the example I just gave you with the inheritance tax and said that, you know, something like that we won't touch. But the other fees and the revenues and things that we collect here, we said, you know what, it's worth holding on to here until, you know, to at least at the minimum send a message to the state that, you know, we need a budget that gets passed.
And what's been the response from the state, either the legislature, I don't know, the governor? Have you gotten any response from this bold move?
No, I mean, nothing official or formal, certainly not from the governor's office. I've talked to some of our legislators here in Bucks County. I shared with them the idea we haven't gotten anything formal to my knowledge. At this point, we haven't, no one's responded formally or officially to us saying, hey, you need to
what
do
are you
this,
doing or... up there in Bucks County? Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Robert Lockery. He's chair of the Bucks County Board of Commissioners, and Bucks County is withholding millions, $4 to $5 million a month that would normally go to the state. The state budget has been essentially on hold. There's been a standoff since July 1st between the governor and the legislature. That's now in its sixth month. And counties across the state are getting frustrated, many of them going into reserve funds, some borrowing money as well. The Bucks County Commissioners decided to do this, and it's a pretty bold move on their part. We want to know what you think. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. What's been the response from the other commissioners across Pennsylvania? Are others thinking about doing this as well, backing you up, signing on, thinking of other ideas?
Well, we've certainly had other counties reach out to us. You know, people that I know from personally that, you know, that have called or emailed and said, hey, that's a good idea. What did you do? And, you know, we shared with them some thoughts. I'm not sure if anyone has done anything formally. I know that some of the counties were considering it. Delaware County, I think I read about, they were looking at doing the same thing. Coincidentally, last week, the County Commissioners Association had their annual meeting. I wasn't at it because I had not originally attended the plan to be there. so I wasn't there, but they discussed it at their annual meeting, and we're going to consider, you know, that as an alternative for other counties to consider. So I've had positive feedback. I'm not sure if any other county has taken this step yet, but it sounded like people were interested in it and wanted to know, you know, how and what we did.
But do you see this as a protest against the legislature and the governor that they have been unable to come up with a budget?
Marty, yes. I mean, truthfully, in the beginning, when I was speaking with, you know, the finance director, you know, and we were just looking at cash flow from a business perspective, saying, okay, well, we've got X amount of money. We got to make it to the end of the year. You know, how much do we need to carry into next year? Usually we have this reserve. We're fortunate, as I said, to have, you know, nearly a $50 million reserve. We've been depleting that. And so we were looking at it from a business standpoint, said, well, like, instead of sending them money, let's just use that money. That's originally what we wanted to do. When we stepped back and took a look at it and said, you know, that might get complicated if you commingle funds because they're from different, you know, as I said, row officers, and some got different strings attached to them. It's probably not the best thing to do to use that money. So then it became, yeah, a protest to say, hey, listen, it just doesn't make sense for us to send you the Commonwealth these dollars when we're on top of that picking up all these extra costs that you should be reimbursing us for. So, you know, protest would be the right way to put it.
Let me get looks like Rick from Warminster to join the conversation. And Rick, go ahead. You're on Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Rick, you are on the air. All right, I'm gonna pull him down. Hopefully, he can get his act together.
I'm right here in Warminster, okay, in the 29th district.
Okay, go ahead.
And I think what's good for the goose is good for the gander.
Meaning?
Because there were federal funds distributed to the Commonwealth, which the governor has withheld, and they were earmarked for schools and social services. So the news this morning is, well, through collaboration with federal authorities, we've been able to distribute some of these for the social services program. It's against the law. When these things are earmarked and they come from the federal funds, he chose not to distribute it to where they were earmarked. So I think what you're doing is exactly correct. Thank you.
Thanks for calling in to Ballot Talks and Radio Times. Robert, anything you want to say back to Rick?
You know, there are, our county budget in Bucks County is roughly $450 million when you carry in all the costs that we have and expenditures that we have. 40% of that, of our revenue for that budget comes from the state. If you look at our budget, half of our budget is towards social services, human services. And if you just look at that part, the revenues, probably 70-80% of that comes from the state. That state money is also federal money, as I think Rick's point is, that
right,
that has been sitting there and that hasn't been able to pass through to us. And that, I mean, that really, you know, begs a question as to why you can't release those funds. And so I think Rick's got a point there.
And just looking at the Pennsylvania budget, broadly speaking, I mean, there's some services, I guess, that are considered essential. I think even including running the legislature, and there are other services that don't fall under that heading. Do I have that right, Robert?
Yeah, I don't know the technical answer to that question, but I mean, what I've been told is that, you know, I don't know how long ago, but a court ruling made it so that state employees, if there were a budget impasse, would continue to be paid, and how they defined essential or non-essential, I don't know. But certainly they haven't felt that pressure the way we are feeling it, and the way our agencies and the nonprofit organizations that we work with are feeling it. I mean, it's a real serious pinch for those agencies and those nonprofits.
Rick, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Let me read an email from Lee. He says, could you ask the commissioner about the partisan nature of this withholding on the part of a Republican-controlled Bucks County, as in this being a political attack on Governor Wolf, who most political experts would agree will bear the brunt of the budget impasse? So do you see this as a partisan attack on the governor?
I don't. I've never said that. I've never pointed the finger at the governor or the legislature. We're pointing it at the government, the state government. And the day we talked about this, Bucks County has two Republican commissioners, and we have a Democrat commissioner, and Commissioner Marseglia, who's the Democrat, was in agreement. In fact, her comment to me was, "We should have done this earlier." I said, "Yeah, I know. If we would only thought about it." I don't think it's been partisan. We've been in agreement here in terms of all three of the commissioners making this decision. And Diane, Commissioner Marseglia, was part of that as well.
Do you have a position on what is being fought about, raising taxes, for instance, privatizing liquor stores, dealing with the pension problem in Bucks County? Have you taken a position on that, or are you just going to let those parties fight it out?
Well, we don't have the county that hasn't taken a position on any of those issues. Certainly philosophically aligned with the Republican points that are out there. But I look, as an elected official, I and each of the other commissioners here, we have a responsibility and a duty to carry out the services that we need to. And a majority of those services we carry out involve, human services, involve working with the elderly, involve drug and alcohol treatments, involve children and youth and child protective services. We need to make sure that those services continue to carry on. And so, if any finger pointing I would do, I want to point the finger at the people who could suffer from not having these services. And that's the responsibility that we have. And so, yeah, philosophically, I'm aligned with obviously more of the Republican points that are out there, but that's not a county position to take. Our position to take is, we've got a lot of responsibilities, a lot of things that we care for, we have to govern and manage here, and we need to do it in a way that's the most prudent, efficient, and the way that helps those who need it most. And we're December, what's the date today? December
3rd, something like that, yes.
Yeah, this is a serious situation for us. Fortunately, we made the decision early on that we would continue to fund these services, and we have, and we want to as long as we can, but we can only go so far.
Now, we've all heard this before. I was reading that there could be a budget agreement this month. Apparently, there are meetings Friday and over the weekend. I don't know if this raises expectations or not. Are you confident that this can be resolved sometime soon?
I'm hopeful. I don't know. I'm confident. You would hope that at some point this can get resolved, and it needs to. And I think if other counties join in the way we have, there's pressure put on that way, that might help get us to the point where we can feel confident. I'm not all that confident, because I think I've heard this before and have felt confident. Early on, I think this is going to get resolved. There's some big issues. They're dealing with a lot of big issues. I get it. And there's a lot of heated emotion on those, and a lot of people with strong opinions and what they think is right and what they think is wrong. I mean, they're big things they're dealing with. But after July, after August, after September, you're kind of like, when will this get resolved? So I'm hopeful. I'm not, all that confident, but I'm hopeful.
Well, we're going to end on that semi-hopeful note. Robert Lockery, thanks so much for joining us today on the show.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. A chair of the Bucks County Board of Commissioners, and they are withholding $4 to $5 million that's collected every month from taxes and fees, normally sent to Harrisburg. They're holding on to that as a protest, as he told us. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program, including podcasts and Facebook and Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.